May it please the court, my name is Bob Trenchard of Weston Trenchard in Kermit, Texas, and we represent the petitioners in this case, Adela Snellenberger and two daughters who are the surviving widow and children of Harold Snellenberger. We filed suit against the respondent, Mrs. Hernandez, under the wrongful death and survival statutes based upon a rescue doctrine theory. Trial court granted summary judgment in favor of Mrs. Hernandez, which was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. Facts of this case are: on March 23, 1984, Mrs. Hernandez was visiting a friend in Pecos. There were seven or eight small children, all under school age, playing in the front yard. Her car was parked in front of the house. When she left the house, by her own admission, she did not look to see whether it was safe to proceed from a parked position. As she started to drive away, she felt her front wheels run over something. She didn't stop. She then felt her back wheels run over something. She didn't stop. Passing motorists flagged her down. It turns out she had run over a two-year-old child, critically injuring this child. Harold Snellenberger was a sergeant with the Pecos Police Department. He and his partner, Officer Spence, were at the police department doing paperwork when the emergency call came in. They immediately ran to their respective vehicles and drove 60 to 80 miles per hour through the city limits of Pecos to the scene of the accident. When they arrived at the scene of the accident, they jumped from their cars and ran to the small child to start preparing her for CPR. Both officers prepared the child for CPR. When they arrived, there was already a crowd of 50 to 60 people who had gathered, which quickly grew to around 300 people. Nobody was calm. Chaotic scene. They started to prepare the child for CPR, and then Officer Snellenberger went to try and hold the crowd back, which included the hysterical mother of the small child. Shortly after that, he fell dead from a heart attack. At that time, Officer Spence was still applying the CPR. Before they started the CPR, the child had no pulse and was not breathing. The child responded after the CPR was applied. Even after Officer Snellenberger's heart attack, Spence continued to apply CPR. And even later, when the EMTs finally arrived, they applied CPR, and even later, the child eventually died. This is a summary judgment case, so the way the evidence is viewed, that is, in the light most favorable to the petitioner, is involved in this case. The holding of the Court of Appeals in this case is, and I want to quote from it, under the facts of this case...
Counsel, what do you believe the reason for that rule is, that we have to view at the high level that we're reviewing, the last level of review, that when a trial judge throws your case out, which is what happened here, saying you had no case as a matter of law, why do we have to give you the benefit of the doubt under the law?
For one reason, in this state and this country, we value the jury system very highly, and somebody's not to be deprived of their right to have a jury hear their case if there are fact issues for that jury to decide. The trial court does not have the right to impose his opinion on the facts for that or what he thinks the jury ought to do. If there are fact issues, the jury is entitled to hear it. So this state, and I believe all other jurisdictions, have the law that the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the losing party on the summary judgment motion, just in case there are fact issues for a jury here.
Well, since Mrs. Hernandez, whom you're suing, never touched the officer, never had any contact with the officer at all, under what legal theory would you assert that you were entitled to recover damages for his death from her? She injured the child.
The legal theory is the rescue doctrine.
Well, explain the rescue doctrine.
Okay, the rescue doctrine is a doctrine which has evolved as a matter of public policy. The landmark case is Justice Cardozo's opinion in the Wagner case many years ago. The public policy, of course, is to encourage and promote humanitarian instincts, and in this particular instance, to promote rescues, to encourage people to rescue, to come to the rescue of somebody in peril rather than to discourage it. And to promote this public policy, there are some special rules that apply to the rescue doctrine, which don't apply when you traditionally analyze a negligence case. One of these rules is the standard of care of the rescuer. He has a lower standard of care. he is not held to be negligent unless his rescue was rashly and recklessly undertaken. Now, that particular rule is not involved in this case.
No one's accusing officer of doing anything wrong.
No, Your Honor.
He just came there trying to help save the child.
The other main rule, or different rule, in the rescue doctrine, which is critical to this case and what this case is all about, is a special rule on foreseeability. This court knows the traditional analysis on proximate cause is cause and fact, foreseeability. You go through that type of analysis. Under the rescue doctrine, it's not that type of analysis.
What do you mean by proximate cause?
Under traditional rules of determining whether or not the defendant's negligence is a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries or damages, as I understand it, you analyze whether there's cause and fact and foreseeability.
And you have to show that in a rescue, even in a rescue.
The rule is different in the rescue doctrine. It's slightly different.
How is it different?
It is different than in that the only thing that need be foreseeable is the rescue itself, not the exact type of resulting injury. Dean Keaton says, Prosser and Keaton, rescuers as a class are always foreseeable when the defendant's negligence endangers anyone. And more importantly, when he's talking about how this rescue doctrine evolved, going back and discussing Justice Cardozo's landmark decision, because when Cardozo was confronted with the issue of foreseeability in Wagner, he declared more or less as an arbitrary rule of most public policy that rescuers as a class are always foreseeable when the defendant's negligence endangers anyone.
Well, if you follow that logical conclusion, in any accident where there had been somebody hurt, any officer that came to the scene then would be a rescuer?
If there was somebody in imminent peril that he had to rescue.
Counselor?
You have to have imminent peril for it. Yes, Your Honor?
Could you distinguish, try to explain to me why this case is not distinguishable from the other rescue doctrine cases, in that the peril created by Ms. Hernandez was in striking the child. That was a accomplished fact before Officer Snellenbacher ever knew that Ms. Hernandez was a child or even in town taking part. She had struck the child was on the ground, critically injured, while he was back in the police station doing his paperwork. Now, how do you bring him within the rescue doctrine when he wasn't, his job was not even, his intention was not to rescue the child from the danger created by Ms. Snellenbacher? And isn't that the essence of the rescue doctrine, that the person is trying to prevent the harm to the victim before it happens? In this case, that is an accomplished fact.
Okay. Well, that's basically the holding of the Court of Appeals, that there was no further danger, that everything was over with.
Well, do you have rescue doctrine cases and authority to prove to us that is not the essence of the rescue doctrine case?
Okay, well, there's a very recent, before I get into that, on most of the rescue doctrine cases, the defendant's negligence is already completed.
Well, the negligence is completed, but is the result of the negligence, i.e., the danger created by the person attempted to be that being rescued. It's the effect of their negligence on the victim, not on the plaintiff.
Right. The victim still has to be in imminent peril, still has to be in danger. And I would say that the holding of the Court of Appeals that there was no further danger, that the parents of this small child would take violent exception to that statement. At the time this heart attack occurred, Officer Snellenbacher is holding back the crowd, including the hysterical mother of the small child. The small child is only being kept alive by CPR. To say that that small child was in no further danger implies there's no difference between a living, breathing child and that same child who was later dead. That is my point, that the child still was in danger. She still was in imminent peril until such point that her condition would have stabilized, if it ever did. You know, and apparently it didn't since she died. At the time that he was attempting the rescue along with his partner, she was in imminent peril. she was in grave danger of dying if somebody didn't rescue her immediately. And the way they were trying to rescue her was by administering CPR.
You're contending that any peril to the child as a result of people crowding around is directly attributable to Ms. Hernandez and not keeping a proper lookout for the child when she started the car.
Yes, I'm contending that it is only the rescue itself which must be foreseeable. The chain of events that naturally follow from that are all recoverable if the rescue attempt was foreseeable, and that my client's decedent was assisting in this rescue attempt at the time he had his heart attack.
Would you explain to us the cases that support this theory?
Well, the Wagner case.
What were the facts in that case?
A man was thrown off a railroad train by the negligence of the railroad. His cousin went looking for him in the dark, and when his cousin was looking for him, he fell off a railroad trestle. A recent case in Texas, First District Houston case, Hennessy versus Perez, 725 Southwest 2nd, 507. No writ. It's a summary judgment case. That's a case where there was an automobile accident and the plaintiffs were called for assistance and trying to flag down cars, and later on were run over by a drunk driver who came on the scene. And that case is interesting for another reason, in that the court analyzes foreseeability in two different ways in that case. First of all, it held that the rescue doctrine is raised under the facts of the case, and that analysis just talks about the foreseeability of the rescue itself, and that the negligence of the defendant is deemed to be approximate cause of the injuries under the rescue doctrine. And then secondly, it goes on to say, even if this weren't a rescue doctrine case, there still shouldn't have been summary judgment granted, and it analyzes proximate cause under traditional methods. The Court of Appeals held in this case that there was no perilous situation existed to invite the rescue.
Before you leave the Houston case, will you file that with the court? Or the case?
No, Your Honor. Yes, I will file it. It's decided this year.
Who wrote the opinion? That's all right.
Okay.
You can tell us in the place.
Okay. The Court of Appeals held there's no perilous situation existed to invite the rescue. To me, a small child who is dying or in danger of dying, has no pulse, no heart rate until CPR is administered, there can be no more classic example of a perilous situation.
Counsel, before you leave the imminent peril, because I think that's a key to the cases that I visualize, is it peril as a result of the negligent act that had already been completed, or is it imminent peril of danger of some negligent acts to follow?
I think it relates back to the original negligence. If the original negligence places a person in peril such that rescue is invited, then that's the foreseeability you're talking about, the foreseeability of the coming of the rescuers. Justice Cardozo said, danger invites rescue. If you negligently put somebody in a position of danger or peril, you invite the rescue, and that's the foreseeability that we're talking about. The Court of Appeals, I think, mistakenly characterized the facts as saying no perilous situation existed, because we know the condition of this small child in the great need of rescue and aid she was in. The court goes on to say the negligent act of a appellee had done all the damage it was going to do. And again, that's my argument about what would the parents of this small child think about this. That's saying there's no difference between a living, breathing child who is being rescued by CPR and that same child who is dead later. Of course, there was more damage to be done. As it turned out, more damage was done. The Court of Appeals also talks about the evidence in the case does not show that Officer Snellenberger was in danger by rescuing any other person. Now that's incorrect. The rescue doctrine does not deal with the danger to the rescuer. It's the danger of the person to be rescued. imminent peril for somebody to be rescued, that's what invites the rescuer. The imminent peril already exists before the rescuer even gets on the scene.
How do you factor in the fact that the police officer had a history of heart problems and high blood pressure and had a pre-existing condition?
The medical evidence is that the extreme physical stress and emotional stress produced by this rescue attempt combined with the pre-existing condition caused the heart attack, which resulted in his death.
You say medical evidence. Is that filed as a part of your response to the summary judgment motion?
Yes, Your Honor. There's an affidavit from a medical doctor.
And we have to discount the pre-existing condition and look only for the opinion of that doctor as a basis for overruling summary judgment.
I don't think you have to discount the pre-existing condition. I think that the injury is recoverable if you have a pre-existing condition, if it's aggravated or worsened. If this is just a heart attack case involving some other type of facts other than the rescue doctrine, I don't think the fact he had a pre-existing condition would preclude recovery if a doctor says that the stress of the situation caused a heart attack that time.
How far, according to your theory, is rescue doctrine stress? Let's change the facts a little bit, and let's say the ambulance got there, and they were on the way to the hospital, and the ambulance driver, being in such a hurry to get that child to the hospital, that he was very slightly negligent. He just cut a corner really fast and had a telephone pole, and the ambulance driver was seriously injured. And is he going to be able to recover from Ms. Hernandez on the rescue doctrine?
I would think so if he did not act rashly or recklessly. I think as long as the child is in an imminent peril because of the negligence of Mrs. Hernandez, anybody who is engaged in reasonable efforts to rescue the child, her negligence is the proximate cause of their injuries and damages until they are no longer attempting to rescue the child or until the child is no longer in imminent peril.
Well, I suppose then we get on to the emergency room of the hospital, everybody's still covered and administering aid to the child.
So long as they are using reasonable efforts and are not rashly and recklessly attempting to rescue the child.
A couple of 3 days later, the child still in the hospital with the nurse on her around. She's treating the child, slips over on a wet floor and breaks the hip. She would be covered then. She's still treating the child as a result of the injury received.
The child is still in imminent peril?
Well, she's in the hospital.
Well, if the child is in imminent peril and in need of rescue, then they're covered. I think it would be hard to argue that 3 days later in the hospital, the child's still in need of rescue.
Isn't that a question for a jury to decide?
Yeah, I think that gets back to there's fact issues in this case. It'd be up to the jury to decide, was this child still in imminent peril? Was she still in need of rescue? I think you'd have a hard time selling to a jury that a child was still in need of rescue 3 days later. But I don't think you'd have a hard time making that same argument on the facts of this case.
I'm having a hard time figuring out how far you're going to carry this. Anybody that gets injured during the period of imminent peril is going to recover. Suppose, for example, Officer Snellenberger has this heart attack, and he's lying there on the ground next to the child, and someone calls Officer Snellenberger's wife and says, "Come over here, your husband's had a heart attack." Well, Mrs. Snellenberger gets there and she is so upset by the sight of her husband that she has a miscarriage. Does she have a cause of action? Because of the trauma that has been caused in the period of stress? Or does the unborn child have a cause of action?
Well, you bring in other theories like bystander's damages.
Well, she wasn't a bystander any more than Officer Snellenberger was.
He's not a bystander. He's a rescuer. She's a bystander to witnessing the injuries of her husband.
Where would cut off liability of those that come upon this scene and by virtue of trauma suffer some injury?
Okay. If you limit it, if we're just talking about the rescue doctrine, I cut it off where anybody who's not a rescuer and anybody who's not rendering aid in rescuing someone in imminent peril. Now, if you get in, bring in the wife or a relative or a bystander, I think then we're talking about something different, whether or not bystander, the rules are going to apply to the situation.
Suppose the bystander became a rescuer with a pregnant wife
Became a rescuer?
Became a rescuer.
Then I think she's covered under the rescue doctrine.
How about the child born as a result of a...
She has a miscarriage because if that's damages that result from the reasonable rescue effort, a rescue that was invited by imminent peril of the person to be rescued, then those damages are recoverable.
What was the officer rescuing who from?
He was trying to save the life of a small child, starting with when he rushed to his car at the police station to the point when he had a heart attack.
Wasn't the damage already done? Hadn't the negligence already occurred?
The negligence had already occurred, but the damage wasn't already done. The child was still alive and being kept alive by CPR.
What about his example about the employee in the hospital?
Well,
the child's still in imminent danger of dying.
If there's a fact issue raised, the child's still in an imminent danger of dying and in need of rescue at that point, then I think it would be up for a jury to decide 3 days later if that's a rescue attempt. I don't think you could convince a jury of that, but that's a different situation.
Have any of the decided cases involving the rescue doctrine made any distinctions where you're dealing with a fireman or a policeman?
The defendant has... Respondent wants this court to bar recovery under the professional rescuer's doctrine or fireman's rule. First of all, and this is probably enough, it's a doctrine based on assumption of the risk. It's an assumption of the risk doctrine. And if that's not enough, secondly, it's been rejected previously by Texas courts. And then if you need to go even further, the policy consideration for the professional rescuer's doctrine or fireman's rule, or first of all, the professional rescuers, as we all know, are already well compensated for taking these risks. It's another part of assumption of risk. Need to spread the risk to the general public instead of to making one wrongdoer pay for it all, because spread the risk through workers' comp and salary and benefits to the firefighters. The other policy consideration is to avoid litigation. And the last one is that property owners, people are going to be hesitant to call firemen and professional rescuers if they know they might have some potential liability. In other words, they're going to let the house burn down because they're afraid they might get sued by the firemen. These policy considerations of the fireman's rule have been characterized by Prosser and Keaton as, quote, preposterous rubbish. If this case is to be decided on public policy, and public policy ought to be a consideration, then the choice is between a policy of the rescue doctrine, which is based upon and encourages the highest humanitarian instincts, and on the other hand, the choice of a policy which has been characterized by a respected writer as preposterous rubbish. This is a summary judgment case. There are fact issues presented. All the Snellenbergers ask and urge is this case ought to be remanded to the trial court for a trial by the jury.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, one more question. Does your theory of rescue doctrine make liable the man with a heart condition the doctor had told him to take it easy, don't exert yourself, and got out and mowed the yard, had a heart attack, the same scenario followed here? Would he be liable to please the doctor for negligently mowing his own grass and having a heart attack?
If the jury found that he was negligent, I think if you place yourself in a negligently place yourself in a situation where you need to be rescued, you're liable to the rescuer.
Do you think that is good public policy?
I think it is a good public policy. It promotes people to attempt to rescue, supposedly. I mean, that's the basis of the policy. Without the policy, you've got to go through real strained reasoning for any rescuer to recover. You're always going to have the argument, well, the negligence is passive, it was over and done with, you know, and this is independent intervening cause, all those types of arguments without this public policy. Your example is not real dissimilar to the Padilla versus Manis and Hooks International case cited in our brief. It's a New Mexico case where the defendant negligently positioned himself under the arms of a front end loader and was pinned when the hydraulics gate came loose, and the plaintiff held up a $2,000 bucket by himself. The trial court instructed verdict for the plaintiff, even though the defendant urged that it wasn't foreseeable that somebody would try to do something impossible, like hold up a 2,000-pound bucket. Later took seven men to hold it up. the doctrine goes quite far, and it needs to go quite far for any rescuer to ever be able to recover without strained logic and being able to avoid interpenitent injury being caused, all these other things that happen between the original negligence and the end result injury.
We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court.
He's going to announce you, and then you can come to the podium and then address that.
May it please the court. Mr. Bruce Baggett will present the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Bruce Bangert, and I practice law in Odessa, Texas, and I represent the respondent in this case, Rosita Rodriguez. Mr. Trenchard and I just have not been able to agree about the foreseeability aspect of the rescue doctrine as it applies in this case, from the standpoint that from the very beginning, he's indicating, and still is today, that only the rescue itself need be foreseeable. But I think the cases we've cited in the brief stand for the simple proposition that not only must the rescue be foreseeable, but the injuries themselves, the harm that was incurred, also has to be foreseeable. I think it's important to note I have no real quarrel with the facts as recited by Mr. Trenchard, except to indicate that there is no evidence in the record standing for the proposition that my client had any notice of the fact that Officer Snellenberger had a pre-existing heart condition.
Counsel, let's take a classic example.
We have a lot of rear-end collisions these days with automobiles that have gasoline tanks that explode and catch the automobile on fire in the microseconds. And a car in the other lane sees the rear end and sees the car burst into flames and it's got two passengers in it, and he attempts a rescue. Are you saying that you couldn't foresee that the gasoline tank might explode?
No, sir, I'm not saying that at all. I think that that's the situation where, yes, foreseeability would apply. The point of the case is, in my view, was my client charged with anticipating that an officer of the law would come out there with a pre-existing heart condition and drop dead from a heart attack? The normal hardihood or fortitude that one reasonably expects, you can take that and extend it one step further by indicating that you take them as you find them. The old soldier's rule, for lack of a better term. But I think those situations pertain to direct contact.
Counsel, do you have a stronger argument than this?
Beg your pardon, sir?
Don't you have a stronger argument than this? Are you hanging your whole case on the fact that this officer had a pre-existing heart condition?
No, sir. Not at all. That's just a fact of the case.
That's what you're coming across so far.
Well, the whole case is, was the heart attack a foreseeable consequence of my client's acts?
Are you saying false grab doctrine applies to rescue situations?
No, sir, I'm not. I don't believe
it. Well, what are you saying?
I'm simply saying that there are cases where they're so bizarre, so extraordinary, so remote, that a person is not chargeable with foreseeing the situation that develops.
And more bizarre or remote than Paul's craft, trying to help a man onto a train and he dropped fireworks and they exploded and it caused the scale to topple over on the woman.
Yes, sir.
What can Ms. Rodriguez foresee will be injuries?
I think that Mrs. Rodriguez in this instance would be chargeable with events such as a vehicular collision on the way to the scene. I think that she could foresee that there might be an altercation between my client and the child's family, the rage of the family as a result of this unfortunate set of circumstances. Those things are foreseeable in the instance of this case, I believe, but not a heart attack. That's
you
too bizarre.
You would say the rescue doctrine would have covered Officer Snellenberger if he had been injured while traveling to the scene of the accident?
Yes, sir. I think that's, in all honesty, a foreseeable event in this sequence.
And you say that if he was happened to be in the car beside the example I gave where there was a rear ender and an explosion, and he jumped out of the car and tried to rescue that hand burn, she would be liable. But suppose he had a heart attack while he was trying to pull her out of the car.
Well, as long as he was actively engaged in some action to extricate the person in peril, I think we're fine. But I think that's the real question in this case, is what was Officer Snellenberger doing out there at the scene at the time? The classic rescue case, rushing into a burning building to save someone, or the cases in the briefs, a burning truck, and a bystander comes by and gets the truck driver out of the burning truck. But what was Officer Snellenberger actually doing here? He had come up and looked at the child, never had any contact with the child. In the process of about 2 minutes, he moves the child's mother back. Admittedly, she's hysteric. I suppose everybody out there, including my client, was. It's not in the record. Then there's a crowd building, and he manages to direct some people back away from the immediate area of the child in order that his partner can freely and unfettered give the assistance the child needs, and the man is gone. And he has done nothing. That's causally related.
Is it foreseeable that Officer Snellenberger might pick up an injured truck child off the ground in order to put that child in an ambulance and in the process rupture a disc and blow back? Would that fall under the rescue gun?
That's the old soldier's rule deal. You take them as you find them. But again, I think it's too remote in this instance. There's no direct.
Would that ruptured disc, trying to rescue the child by putting it in an ambulance, would you say that's coverable or not coverable?
I'd say that's a terribly close case. That's a tough case. Whether someone is...
Who should make a decision? Who should decide?
As a matter of law, in this instance, our contention is that no one is charged with foreseeing a heart attack in facts of this kind. Now, a ruptured disc, if you hurt someone and incapacitate them, common sense dictates that someone's going to have to come out there and move that person. And if they happen to have a bad back and in the process injure themselves, possibly that's a foreseeable consequence. I think it's important to note at this time, it's my understanding that the rescue doctrine originally emanated out of the need for a plaintiff to have a defense to an allegation of contributory negligence. And that's where I think it came from. The earlier cases seem to suggest that, and even the more recent ones, because the contention or the citing of the rote of the matter always seems to indicate unless this action was recklessly or wantonly done. But there are cases where it's allowed as a cause of action in and of itself in this jurisdiction. But again, not only the rescue has to be foreseeable, but the injuries themselves.
Well, Mr. Banger, isn't it an element of rescue doctrine that the rescuer must expose himself to some danger?
Yes, sir.
And what is the danger to which he exposed himself in this case?
There is none. That's our position, that he incurred no danger. He exposed himself to no danger in this instance. There was not a riot to quell out there. There was not a fire to put out. There was not any continuing active negligence. That gets us to the fireman's rule, which simply indicates that a claimant should not recover because of his presence in an instance for which he has been employed. And that's a duty aspect rather than anything else, in my view. But the situation regarding the fireman's rule is just offered as a rationale for the correctness of the decision in this particular case.
Counselor, let me hear your contention that the injury itself must be foreseeable as opposed to a danger being foreseeable. Don't you run into an awful lot of law to the contrary there?
general rule is, plaintiff, the defendant must foresee that the thing that you're going to be in danger, but you don't have to foresee the specific injury?
No, sir. I think that all of the cases, it's in the conjunctive. Must foresee not only the rescue, but also and the injury itself. I think the Redeker case, all of the cases in this jurisdiction that I've been able to find, established foreseeability has to be in existence regarding both aspects of the case.
Well, are you contending then that this rescue doctrine, the foreseeability on the part of the defendant, is different than the regular negligence case?
I think either way we go, we're still confronted with an as a matter of law, this bizarre...
Well, my point is, you're zeroing in on the heart attack itself. Now, isn't the general rule in a negligence case, the plaintiff must be able to foresee that he's putting the defendant in danger, not that that this specific injury is going to occur to the defendant? In other words, you drive recklessly, there's a good chance you're going to run into another automobile, and those passengers are going to be in danger. You don't have to foresee, well, this person is going to get a bump on his head, and this person is going to get a broken leg. And as I understand your argument, you seem to be saying in this rescue doctrine situation, the foreseeability is different. You must foresee a specific injury.
Well, not necessarily a specific injury, but something of a general nature that makes common sense. It's within the realm of what we can reasonably expect of each other in communal society. I would cite you to the Bigham case, 1896. That's the case that indicated that it would take prophetic kin to have foreseen the bizarre events that unfolded in that case. And I had to go look up kin in the Webster's, but it's an extraordinary vision. Now that's an old case that I understand is still the law. In that case, that's the TNP Railway Company versus Bigham, there was a gate on a cattle pen that was allowed to become in disrepair. And the court reasoned that it was foreseeable that gate in that condition could cause situations such as the cattle getting out and being damaged or lost. But the claimant in that case was in a position by the gate when the cattle stampeded, and he was hurt in the process, and they denied him recovery. I'd cite you to the Corey versus Pure Distributing case. Now that's the case where a fastener on a truck was allowed to become in disrepair, and as a consequence, the oil can flew off the truck, fell to the ground. The lid on the can flew off and hit a man on the head who was camped by the side of the road. They allowed him recovery in that case. However, his wife was present at the time, and she miscarried a child. And they said no recovery. Too remote. The husband was allowed recovery, but the wife's miscarriage was denied. And I think that's what we're talking about, drawing a line based on human experience.
Those cases, I don't think we have any problem there. I just...
Yes, sir.
Differently, I think.
What is the law question here you say you ought to prevail upon? Duty or foreseeability?
Foreseeability. But as far as foreseeability is, as you well know, an aspect of duty as well, as I understand.
Dean Keats says, Dean Green say foreseeability is part of proximate cause.
I think foreseeability has to do with duty as well.
Yeah.
You foresee that your conduct might create a certain situation, and then you have a duty to guard against the logical, reasonable results.
Clearly, if it's a duty question, it can become a question of law.
Yes, Your Honor.
But when would causation not be a fact situation?
You mean cause in fact?
Well, proximate cause. When would...
Extraordinary cases.
Isn't almost routinely proximate cause a fact question?
Yes, sir. I think so. I'd have to concede that fact. Most often it is. But this court can override a jury's decision in this area, can substitute their discretion for a jury's in instances of this kind if the situation is extraordinary enough.
Would you draw the line if there is no contact between the victim and the rescuer that the rescuer cannot recover?
Yes, sir. Again, I think that comes down to the active and passive, the creation of a condition, the Scurlock case that's in my brief.
That would make it a law question, wouldn't it? If you just draw the line and say, if you don't touch the victim, you have no cause of action.
Yes, sir. The Kaufman case, the truck driver with the neurosis, of course, that's gone into your bystander recovery cases now, and it's a kind of a hard area of the law to categorize. Where do you put it? What do you do with it? But again, normal hardihood and fortitude, and in an instance of this kind, if you don't do anything actively, if your negligence has come to rest, as we contend my clients did in this instance, and she did nothing to this officer.
Aren't you now hitting a point that has to be wrestled with to decide this case? Most rescue doctrine cases involve a continuing peril from the action that was negligent, from which someone is trying to rescue. That's not applicable here, it seems to me pretty obviously. The act of negligence is over and done. But counsel contends that this danger or peril doesn't have to just be limited to the danger or peril created by that accident or that negligence, but if peril still remains to the victim, danger still remains to the victim. Like here, the child's about to die. If the rescue doctrine continues on, he then can get the benefit of foreseeability. It's sort of a step out from the normal rescue doctrine case.
And
that's what he's contending. He says, you asked that mother of that child whether the danger still existed, and she would say, yes, it did, because my child was about to die. It wasn't as a result then of, he wasn't rescuing the child from something that was continuing in the air like an explosion or something that's still continuing. That's all over. But he's trying to rescue her from the danger she's in from dying.
If my client can expect that the officer is going to be, to quote a term from New York City, Pecos finest, and physically fit and capable of contending with that type of situation, I don't see it. There has to be a continuing danger. We violently disagree about that. And the fact that the child has been injured.
That's what the Court of Appeals said. It seems to me that you may not be paying much attention to the Court of Appeals writing. They just said the perilous situation has to still be existing to invite the rescue. They seem to say, in the last paragraph says, evidence does not show that Officer Schellenberger exposed himself to any danger. Mm-hmm. That's Judge Campbell's question. This counsel, the petitioner, says it doesn't have to just be the danger to the officer, it can be the danger to the victim. Well, you've got to solve that for me.
Well,
that's still troubling me.
I have to say that I agree with the Court of Appeals' decision from that standpoint.
But there must be a continuing danger in order for the doctor to
Yes, sir, that has a causal relation, a bridge of the gap between my client's negligence and the injury complained of.
And that's not saying continuing danger.
Yes, sir, I think so. The damage was done. The passive of the negligence had come to rest. There was no threat any longer other than the horrible injuries inflicted on the child. And this invited nothing more or less other than simply the officer going out there and doing the job he was hired to do. Work the wreck. Handle a crowd. Comfort the mother. but he had nothing to do with the child that, that you can bridge the gap with or continue the danger. There was no danger. The child was in danger of dying, admittedly, and needed attention desperately.
What you're saying is if he had been administering the CPR at the time he suffered a heart attack, there would be recovery?
I would make this concession. If the case was Officer Spence, the one that was actually doing the CPR rather than Officer Snellenberg, I think I'd be in a lot more trouble than I am from that standpoint. And argue.
The judgment would have been proper in that case?
On the heart attack aspect of it, the foreseeability of the specific injury suffered, I would still have tried to get a summary judgment, yes. There is...
Anything else, counsel?
Well, I would just like to point out in closing that I'm not unmindful of recent events, and I'll cite the court to the El Chico case in June, and I think it was a tough, good, hard decision that had to be made. But I would invite the court to weigh this particular case based upon the principles and theories announced in El Chico. And I think if you will, you'll find that there is no compelling social demand or any type of changing need of contemporary society that would dictate that you abrogate any of the basic rules that I think control in this case. And from that standpoint, I really do feel, as I say, Mr. Trenchard and I have gone long and hard at this. We just don't seem to be able to agree on anything, but there was no duty and there was no foreseeability as an essential element of proximate cause concerning this particular very bizarre set of facts.
Before you sit down, are you going to respond to this professional rescue doctrine argument? You have some of it in your brief. Are you really seriously asserting that that is the law of this state, or it should be the law of this state? What do you say?
No, Your Honor, it is not the law of this state. And I'm not saying that it should be. It's offered as a rationale for the correctness of the summary judgment result in this case, based again, I think, upon the basic theory of it is that there is no duty to these people that are hired to go out and contend with this. If you extend it on to its logical conclusion, Officer Snellenberger would have been out of a job based on the fact that if we're all to be held to a test that requires that we not create these situations, well, then there's no need for these public servants.
Thank you, counsel. All
right. Well, I hate to get back into duty, but there is always a duty to a rescuer. Danger invites rescue. You got the imminent peril, and you got a duty to the rescuer. Another part of the doctrine.
Counsel, but isn't the basic question danger to whom? Danger to the rescuer or rescue?
No, the danger, the imminent peril, in the way it's in the pattern jury charge, they just have the contributory negligence submission, but it does have the imminent peril submission. It's talking about the imminent peril of the person to be rescued. The imminent peril has to exist to invite the rescue. It is already present before the rescuer gets on the scene. The danger speaks of the danger to the small child, not also
the question
Standard.
We're trying to raise is that imminent peril or danger have to come from the action or negligence, or can it just come later on, like here, where the child is about to die?
I think you have to have a finding that the defendant's negligence created and imminent peril. That's the one finding you have to have. And if that imminent peril invites rescue, that's the foreseeability you're talking about. You do have to have a finding of negligence, and you do have to find that that negligence created the imminent peril, which I think is the case in the Snellenberger facts.
What do you say about the Court of Appeals holding continuing danger?
Well, I think my best argument is how would the parents of this child respond to that? obviously that there's a continuing danger to this child. She wasn't breathing, had no heartbeat before the CPR, and is being kept alive with CPR and still in need of it even after the heart attack. She's in great imminent peril.
What was Officer Schnellenberger doing to rescue her in that imminent peril?
One of them had to administer the CPR. Both of them, in the record, did prepare for the CPR. One of them had to administer to her, and somebody had to hold back those 300 people. Evidence is nobody was called. Officer Spence said it's the most stressful situation he's ever been in his life. Among those 300 people he's trying to hold back is the hysterical mother of the small child. To me, what he was doing to rescue that child, extricate her from this situation, keep her alive, get her out of there, was just as important as what Officer Spence was doing. Officer Spence could not have continued with the CPR if the mother had got to him or if the crowd kept pushing up to him. But both they were doing was very important to the rescue effort.
So you're saying the crowd control, in effect, was a continuing portion of CPR which was being administered by Officer Smith.
Right. I think the evidence is Spence told Schnellenberger, or Schnellenberger said that Spence, somebody's got to do something about the crowd. And he had to push, the evidence is he had to push, hold the crowd back, including the hysterical mother of the small child. You can imagine what that scene was like. 300 people crowded around a critically injured small child, chaos, with a mother screaming, trying to get at the child.
This has nothing to do with it, but of course the population of Pecos, you know, I get the impression that Pecos is a very small community. You've got 300 people there, there's a whole town there?
Well, no, I think it's like 8 or 10,000 people, but that is a large crowd for Pecos. It's not the only time you get a larger crowd is at a football game, maybe. The Skirlock case that he discussed, I'm not aware that even mentions the rescue doctrine. The Hennessy case was written by Justice James F. Warren. That's the Houston case that was decided this year.
That's at 725 Southwest.
Yes, sir. 725-507. It's no writ. It quotes from the Longacre case, which most of the rescue doctrine cases do. The underlying basis of the rescue doctrine is the defendant negligently created a situation which provoked the rescue effort, and the rescuer's resulting injury was something that could be reasonably have been foreseen by the negligent defendant and was a natural and probable result of such negligence. That is awkwardly saying what the courts in other states have said and what Dean Keaton talks about when he says, as an arbitrary rule, we're just going to say that all you have to have is foreseeability of a rescuer, and then the damages resulting during a reasonable rescue effort are recoverable. The danger is always to the person to be rescued. You may also have danger to the rescuer, but the danger that invites rescue, you're talking about the person to be rescued. The continuing
that the dashing into the burning barn is not an apt analogy here.
It's analogous, it's not important that the person who was doing the rescue and ran into the burning barn put himself in danger. What's important is there was some danger to life or property that caused him to do that. On the continuing peril, often in these cases the negligence has already ceased. On these car wreck cases, like the New Hennessy case and the Hale versus Burgess case, the wrecks already occurred. And then later somebody else comes along and runs into the rescuer. In the Hennessy case, all the rescuers had done is one of them called the police and they helped the police officer set out the flares and were preparing to leave when a drunk driver came over and crashed into them. The continuing peril is not related to or tied to continuing active negligence by the defendant. Mrs. Hernandez doesn't have to keep back and forth over this small child to be liable under the rescue doctrine. All that need be is for there still to be a continuing peril to the child such that a rescue is invited. And as long as Officer Schnellenberger is involved in this rescue effort which was invited, and as long as the child is in imminent peril, then I believe the law is he ought to be covered. At the very least, I believe a jury ought to be able to rule on these fact issues.
When does a continuing peril I'm going to back the question Justice Wallace asked you about getting the child to the hospital.
I think it's a fact issue. For one thing, we're talking about negligence issues, foreseeability issues, which are always fact issues. At some point, it has to end. That point is when the rescue is no longer invited. I think that somebody to be a rescuer has to be engaged in a rescue.
Well, they're still attempting to rescue that child if they're administering surgery. What if the surgeon, in the process of operating on the child, I don't know, not involved here, but what if the surgeon, in operating on the child, injured himself in some manner, cut himself with his scalpel or something? Would that fall under the rescue doctrine?
If the small child was still in imminent peril and in need of rescue, and what he was doing was rescuing the child, and if he did not act rashly or recklessly, then he's covered. I think even Mr. Bangert agrees that if the ambulance drivers have had a wreck on the way to the scene, they'd be covered. And I think in this situation where the EMT still had to give the girl CPR after they picked her up, that they'd be covered on the way to the hospital. Now, at what point the rescue doctrine coverage ends, I don't know. But I think it is a question of fact, I believe.
How would you submit the issue to the jury? Was the child still in imminent peril at the time the injury occurred?
Whether the defendant was negligent, whether that negligence created a situation of imminent peril for the child, such that the child needed to be rescued, whether Officer Snellenberger attempted to rescue the child, did he not engage in reckless rescue efforts? Was he injured as a result of the rescue effort? I think it's a correct submission. Thank you.
We'll take a short recess.
The audience will be right.